TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Big Tech Interview with Anand Giridharadas on Winners Take All. How Taxes, Not Philanthropy, Will Change the World. In this January 2020 episode of Big Tech, co-hosts Taylor Ohn and David Skok speak with Anand Giridharadas, author of Winners Take All. Big Tech is a podcast about the emerging technologies that are reshaping democracy, the economy, and society. The podcast is a project of the Center for International Governance Innovation in Canada. Here's Big Tech.
In a wide-ranging and sometimes heated interview with Anand, we tackle his worldview and some of the solutions that he may propose. I want to welcome New York Times bestselling author Anand Giridharadas to the show. Anand is editor-at-large at Time Magazine and a political analyst for NBC News. And today, we're going to be speaking about his latest book, Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Welcome to the show, Anand.
Thank you for having me.
In your book, you suggest that the great harm of our era is inequality and the concentration of money and power among a select few. In the U.S., for example, 3.5 decades worth of change and growth has had zero impact on the average pay of 117 million people. Is this in part because we have replaced social democracy with social entrepreneurship?
I think in part, but I think it's bigger than that. I think the story I tell in Winners Take All is that there has been, over the last 30, 40 years, a massive cultural project prosecuted by the richest and most powerful people and the biggest corporations and the biggest fortunes to sell us on the idea that government is bad, regulation is bad, taxes are bad, and that companies change the world, and that philanthropy is how you change the world, and that impact investing, which is just adding the word impact to the old thing that investors used to do and claiming to have a little bit more social consequence, is how you change the world. That ice cream companies that give back a little bit is how you change the world. That tote bags and things involving Bono are how you change the world. And what you see as a result is all of these efforts everywhere to change the world from on high, not through movements, not through democracy, but through rich people being kind, waking up with a good feeling on a particular day and wanting to be kind. And we see these efforts everywhere. And I wrote the book to challenge the notion that these efforts are what they seem. Because if these efforts are all that great, why is it that we live in an age in the United States in which it's the worst time to be a regular person in 100 years? Why is it that this has been an era of growing concentration of wealth and power, not reducing? The burden is not on those of us criticizing plutocracy to make our case. The burden is on the plutocrats to justify themselves and to explain why, if all these efforts that they do to fight for equality and justice are what they claim to be, how come things are getting worse on that front year by year?
I mean, I think you're right that the argument you make is much broader. And if we were talking about this same thing 100 years ago, the plutocrats would have been the industrialists. But now, in many ways, they are the tech sector. Right? And the ecosystem and economy that revolves around them. And I thought one of the anecdotes or sort of scenes you paint in the book around being on the Summit Sea Boat was sort of indicative of this. And I'd kind of heard of this conference before, and I think it kind of sums up a lot of what you're talking about. But this scene with Chris Sacca and Edward Snowden talking about solving the world's problems and them just having like fundamentally different visions of that. Can you talk a little bit about that? And like, how does that tell us about tech and specifics role in this broader economic structural problem you're talking about?
Well, look, you know, for the sake of all your listeners, I went on a cruise ship with 3,000 entrepreneurs who believe they're changing the world so that none of you have to.
Thank you.
You know, and I believe that is an act of philanthropy in and of itself, by the way. I may be critical of philanthropy, but that was the most charitable thing I've done in a long time. So I hung out with these, you know, entrepreneur types who, you know, almost to a person on that particular ship would not say that they're just launching a business. They're just trying to make money. They're almost all in the business of changing the world. So you have these conversations and you start to realize that what they're really talking about is this ideology that they all share, which is this win-win ideology. And you're right, it is particularly acute and concentrated in the tech sector, which has become not only the biggest emergent power center in the world, but has become a place of monopoly, of rampant abuse of privacy and of democracy, of fomenting violence through platforms like WhatsApp without any kind of responsible fixing of those problems. And you start to say, how are these people who are talking about changing the world owners of this incredibly predatory industry that began 20 years ago with promises of leveling playing fields and flattening hierarchies and empowering people at the margins and has become more concentrated than the economy that it replaced? And we had way more than five companies with that much power. Those five companies, if you look at their fraction of capital expenditure in the U.S., it's like an enormous fraction. So how do we get there? And the argument of that particular chapter in the book is that the story the tech sector tells is a story of powerlessness. That's how they lubricate their power, right? It's the story of we are rebels against the man. We're not the man. We're rebels against the man. We're fighting the man. We're bringing down the man. We're fighting the powers that be. We're Uber fighting against the corrupt taxi cartels, as one of the characters in the book talks about. We are Facebook trying to, you know, democratize community and, you know, get rid of the old gatekeepers and so on and so forth. And this self-image of powerlessness, of the rebel spirit, is an incredibly effective way to grab power while deceiving people about what you're doing. And the simple example that I use in the book, I think that chapter is called Rebel Kings in Worrisome Berets. Sometimes, from time to time, you have in a poor country that's going through some kind of armed insurgency, and you got this rebel army that's out there trying to overthrow the president or the king or whatever. And these rebels, you know, often will wear berets. And sometimes the rebel army wins, takes over the country. And I always say to people, it's a really bad sign if your rebel leader, upon becoming president, keeps the beret. If they keep the beret, it means they still think of themselves as an insurgent. Like Saddam kept the beret, right? And what it means is these guys didn't transition from being on the outside of power to being power in their own minds. And when you are powerful but deny your own power, it's not a humility, it's abusive. It actually explains how someone like Mark Zuckerberg can be selling out American democracy for profit and still genuinely feel in his heart that he is a builder of community. And I think we need new stories and truthful stories to combat these bullshit stories.
So I think you're right. I mean, there's no question they've taken over some of the governance roles and large swaths of what was once the social democratic state. Do you think that some of that story is right, that that state was atrophying, that those democratic institutions were failing, that the industrial economy was exclusive, that the media structures were excluding too many, and that some of what they have replaced it with has been ultimately more democratic or more participatory?
No. You know, there has been, and this is where we need to wake up as citizens, there has been a very concerted, organized plan that Jane Mayer in the book Dark Money lays out in great detail in the United States. Well, you literally had five families on the right. There was a small rinky-dink operation at the start that pushed this idea of let's shift the culture to not believe in government and believe more in business. And they did it. And it's like a plan. Like they met, they had meetings, they had committees, they wrote reports, they rebranded stuff, they funded institutes, like they did it. And then the rest of us, like idiots, are downstream being like, yeah, I guess government's not that effective. Like we are literally saying the thing they just paid for us all to be saying, thinking we're feeling original thoughts. So I'm trying to move the Overton window on this conversation. I actually don't accept the premise that government is a place of ineffectiveness and the private sector is full of dynamism. What's the evidence? I actually think the government would be able to do a lot of what it does in the absence of people like Mark Zuckerberg, but I do not think Mark Zuckerberg would be able to do anything in the absence of the United States federal government. So if all these people are so hostile to government, how come they never start their country? There's a lot of countries in the world that do not have effective, capable government. Maybe more countries than have it, right? If you really like an open environment, how come none of these Silicon Valley people start their company in Somalia? I'm sure the government in Somalia would leave you alone to a great extent. I'm not sure they have the capacity to regulate you in the way that we annoyingly regulate you in some of these Western countries. If it's so annoying to you, how come you never incorporate there? That's kind of interesting, isn't it? All these banks that say this regulation is not good. So interesting. There's a bunch of countries that don't do meddlesome banking regulation. How come you never found your banks there? Kind of interesting.
Well, one of the places where they do incorporate is Netherlands because of tax or legal benefits of doing so. Just last week, there was a case here in Canada about Uber in the Supreme Court challenging on the premise of Dutch law, not Canadian law, their place and how they treat their workers. Which leads me to a bigger question that you kind of raised, but and I don't want to go down the rabbit hole of woe is capitalism, but it's hard for me to hear you talk and not think about the larger systems at play. So
that's what we should be thinking about.
We talk about venture capital. Venture capital is just about telling a story so you get more money. As someone who's raised money recently, I can tell you that, you know, it's all about what is the story that you're going to tell that sounds compelling so you can get more capital. Well, that capital, those venture capital firms have their own, they're beholden to their own pension funds or whomever else, institutional investors that have put money in on their behalf. And so when we think about the tech companies and the role of Chris Sacca or even Mark Zuckerberg, are they not just small peas in a much larger game here that is, you know, the BlackRocks of the world and the CPPIBs of the world?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Winners Take All is a book about individuals. I think it's a book about a system, and it tells the stories of individuals to try to illustrate and illuminate a system. But you're right, the system is market fundamentalism, which is, in addition to being a structural system, is a belief system. I have friends who, you know, are in the dating market, and they use the term the dating market. I have friends who use words like optimization to describe their experience of dating. Business has become, in many of our worlds, our culture, right? It's become our common language. It's become our way of seeing the world, which is separate and apart from saying there's the distribution of resources is off, which is true. But what's making all of this possible is a bad culture, a culture that has, you know, I was walking through an airport the other day. I'm just looking at all these restaurants in the airport, you know, and they're all just so ugly. These restaurants and the chairs. And it's just like, and this is really particularly true in America, where everything in this restaurant has been optimized. The question driving this was never, what would the most beautiful version of this restaurant concept look like? None of those restaurants are owned by a single person owning a single restaurant. They're all probably owned by private equity companies that are owned by, and you can just see that you have an entire landscape now where the only question asked is how to maximize profitability. I am not suggesting that that's a question that we should ban from our society. I'm suggesting it's not the only question that should drive our society.
You worked at McKinsey. McKinsey is a place that does think of itself, it's had some rougher press stories of late, but overall it sees itself as a good in the world. How do you reconcile the way that McKinsey thinks about itself in the world versus the optimization projects that you were, I assume, a part of?
Well, my own experience of it was pretty negative. And was an awakening to me in how easy it is to sell people a story that is not based in reality, you know? I think a lot of people are overpaying for their advice. And they're getting a certain kind of advice that's disguised as being, you know, sage and truthful, but comes from a particular way of looking at the world that's not inevitable. And the problem is not just the advice that they give their clients, but that the McKinsey way of looking at life has really spread. So now in nonprofits and in academia and in journalism and all these other worlds, there's a pressure to think in that way. Whereas in fact, what actually needs to happen is you need the way people think in academia and journalism and nonprofits and medicine to actually colonize the business world. In fact, the colonization is happening the wrong way. And one of the things that I found is that in McKinsey in particular, there was this construction of authority that you learn to do as like a 21 or 22-year-old when you really literally know nothing. But if you can just learn to talk in a certain way and construct authority for what you may privately be profoundly unknowledgeable or even insecure about, knew that because I saw people myself, others, but if you can just learn to perform the authority, you can really help push society in this like very different way. If you can perform authority, you can get that company to do 50,000 layoffs and justify it as, you know, being wise and sage and the sober thing to do. And I think we just need new frameworks, and we need the frameworks of the business world to have less power over life in other domains and the frameworks of other domains to actually inform how business is done.
One of the other structures your book dives into is this: how and when do you bring either academic ideas or public-facing ideas out into the public, and via what mechanisms?
Yeah, I mean, I think that chapter is called The Thought Leader and the Critic. And what I try to get at in that part of the book, I mean, much of the book is about the structures and cultural ideas that uphold this age of inequality and plutocracy, right? So if it comes to be believed that women can be empowered through lean in and raising their hand as opposed to structural change, that's a fraudulent claim that has no basis in reality. But if we can make that available and widely believed in the culture, then it may reduce the pressure to do universal daycare. If it can be widely believed in the culture that, you know, just doing a little more testing for minority kids in schools will fix educational equity, we actually don't have to give people equal schools instead of allocating public school funding depending on how nice your mommy or daddy's house is, which is what we do in America. You know, we're able to do it in a way that doesn't require structural change, which is nice for rich people. So what starts to happen is there starts to be a demand for thinkers to supply the justifications for change light, for plutocracy, for not doing the structural change, for doing the lighter approach. And so there's this temptation that comes in to, if you are a thinker thinking critical thoughts on patriarchy or on white supremacy or any of these other social challenges, to change the way you talk, to change things, to make them, to basically sound the opposite of how I might sound right now, to make things not blamey, not about structural fixes, not going after anybody, not saying anything negative, just talking about positive solutions. If you're willing to do that and sound like that, the plutocracy opens its doors to you. And the plutocracy now owns a lot of the great intellectual stages, right? As newspapers have declined, as academia has become more precarious, less tenure jobs, more adjunct jobs, a lot of the traditional platforms for supporting yourself as a thinker have withered.
How do you reconcile the idea that these arguments that you're making, the very same people who you're trying to reach or who have had this platform are they inviting you, or are they not inviting you at the dinner table to have these conversations with them?
They're not who I'm trying to convert. I'm trying to convert regular people to take power back from plutocrats. I mean, if I wanted to reach plutocrats, I could just write them letters. There's not that many of them. You don't write something in Time magazine because you want to reach plutocrats. You write something in Time magazine because you want to reach 2 million middle-class people in the United States. So, you know, I don't go on TV to reach plutocrats. I can go to Aspen to reach the plutocrats. I go on MSNBC because I want to reach, you know, people working three jobs who might get 5 minutes of thinking about our age in a slightly different way. And what I'm trying to suggest to those people is that I think most of them want transformational change. I mean, the desire for transformational change in the United States is significant. And we have outsourced the job of achieving that change to the people with the most to lose from such change.
I was particularly struck in watching the Prop C discussion for homelessness in San Francisco last year, and how you had different tech leaders rallying on different sides of this. Was there anything that you learned from that process, or that you were actually inspired by in that process?
You know, I wrote a piece for The New Yorker about the billionaire bros beef between Mark Benioff and Jack Dorsey. And it was very interesting because, you know, they really were at loggerheads over this proposal to raise taxes on some of the biggest companies in San Francisco in order to, in a dedicated way, fund initiatives for the homeless. And the argument was like this. The mayor of San Francisco, London Breed, the new mayor at the time, opposed this because she feared, it was kind of an unusual argument, she feared all this money coming in before they had a plan for how to spend it was going to overwhelm the city. And she felt it was better to like have a plan first before you raise this money. And so Jack claimed that, you know, he was deferring to the mayor, deferring to a democratically elected person and not wanting to supersede that. But of course, he was also therefore opposing a tax that would have cost him a bunch of money. Mark Benioff took the view that this homelessness thing is abhorrent and we should raise taxes on companies like his, which I thought was an interesting and important stand, but he violated a kind of different value, which is that he therefore spent a lot of his own money on political advocacy, trying to influence the election in that way, which is problematic in its own right and maybe anti-democratic in its own right, to achieve something that he felt was more humane. And so it was an interesting collision between kind of different views. I mean, yes, should you raise taxes? That's good. But should you defer to democratically elected officials? That's good. And it kind of pitted all of that against each other. They ended up passing it. I think it's tied up in court now, but it's a lot of money that they've raised that's tied up in court. And I remember having occasional chats with Mark during this process for him, just like this awakening of realizing that it is actually not the same to raise $100 million from rich people to solve that problem and to raise $100 million in taxes. This is something a lot of rich people don't understand until they get into the weeds of this. There is an enormous moral difference between five guys deciding to do something and a city deciding to do something. This is something I think you wouldn't have had to explain to people 100 years ago or 200 years ago when we actually had more faith in the idea of democratic action. But in our culture, it's like, well, if you can have $100 million, who cares who spends it? Maybe it's even spent more effectively by five rich guys. And the reality is, it matters who does something. It matters what entity does something, right? It's the same thing for hunger. It's the same thing for social welfare programs. Philanthropy is not the same thing as taxation. And that's something that I think a lot of rich people need to understand or are in various stages of learning.
So who is learning it? I mean, you mentioned Benioff. Are there others out there that you would consider the most interesting traders to their class?
You have a wave of folks who are really raising the ultimate taboo, which is advocating for a wealth tax, right? Abigail Disney, there was a letter that Abigail signed that involved, I think, a member of the Pritzker family, some others. That's, I think, where the frontier of this conversation among rich people is. And I talked to some of these folks by virtue of the book, and I think there's a real awareness that on the giving side, they need to be class traders if they're going to do philanthropy and actually do the kind of philanthropy that is going to help end the Second Gilded Age, not just treat people for symptoms incurred because of the Second Gilded Age. And there's a recognition that they're going to have to actually give up power.
That's my cynical brain coming to the fore, which is it a recognition for the good of humanity, or is it a recognition that if they don't, the pitchforks will be outside their mansions?
I think it's both. You know, I think the pitchforks thing is a nice rhetorical thing. I mean, I just don't think that's like actually what's motivating. I think it's motivating some people maybe. But, you know, the form the pitchforks take is not actual pitchforks. It's going to be just like rising resentment and chaos. And, you know, I think Donald Trump has been very radicalizing for a lot of people. Like, it's not like someone's going to come to your house and stab you. It's more just like, I mean, Lloyd Blankfein, the former CEO of Goldman Sachs, who I don't agree with probably on anything, but he said the other day, would I pay a few more taxes to live in like a less mean, chaotic society? Yes, I would. I'm not sure if he's really going to push for that, but he's on the right track. Like, it's not fun to live in a society where that is so polarized, so angry, so full of scapegoating. And that's the kind of society you have when there's this kind of scarcity. And so I think there's a case to be made that these societies are more fun to live in when most people are provided the rudiments of a dignified, decent life.
The wealth tax is one thing, and kind of broader economic structures are critical. But I sometimes wonder if the way platforms are stepping into this space, like Facebook's oversight board, for example, right? Trying to find their own way of governing speech for everybody in America and everybody, frankly, around the world. If that's not in part because governments have not stepped into that space and have abdicated their responsibility to govern the digital public sphere, for example. So do you think beyond the antitrust movement that we're starting to see, the wealth tax movement that get at the economic structures, there's actually a broader range of things governments need to do to actually govern the digital economy in this part of our lives?
I think the biggest issue is the imbalance of power, particularly with regard to tech. That it just has way too much power relative to users and way too much power relative to the state. If you look at the banking industry, which is a very powerful industry, the other big kind of leg of the American economy, it is a heavily regulated industry. And by the way, it still makes a ton of money, but we are protected from its depredations in all kinds of ways. It's not perfect, but imagine what the world would be like if there wasn't that infrastructure. And there's basically none of that infrastructure for tech. You know, so I'm glad that there's thousands of pages of regulations protecting my car insurance loan. I mean, thank you. But also, car insurance doesn't make me like that vulnerable compared to like Mark Zuckerberg's power over my life and my democracy and whether or not Russia is waging cyber war on my account. I don't understand why my car insurance is more regulated than Mark Zuckerberg. I don't understand, by the way, why Mark Zuckerberg is the subject of poo-pooing instead of a criminal inquiry. Like, we have just hugely gotten wrong this approach to tech, this veneration of the entrepreneur, and, you know, world leaders sitting on stages with Mark Zuckerberg talking. Like, these are pariahs. These are the modern robber barons who need to be put in their box through regulation, through law, through policy, through taxation, and not be venerated as heroes, and not be given new philanthropic territory, the public education system, the world of public health, to like go rich-splain their way into those domains too.
U.S. election will be decided a year from now. What do you hope the discourse will be, and what issues do you hope will come up and surface in this campaign?
I love this campaign. I couldn't believe in this. This Democratic primary is fantastic. A lot of people are tired of it, exhausted of it, don't like the sniping, don't like the number of candidates. I think it's a fantastic primary. I think this is a graduate seminar level debate about capitalism, socialism, and democracy, as Schumpeter put it. And I think we are having it out in a way that countries often keep things under the rug or don't, you know, talk about deficits or some narrow proxy issue. Like, we're talking about it in this primary. We are talking about, are you a capitalist or you're not? We got diversity on that question in this primary. We're talking about, is big structural change more electric, more necessary in general, and more electric to people in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania who are important in this election, you know, or being moderate and careful and cautious and tweaking, right? We're talking about whether McKinsey as a background is a boon or a problem. We're talking about whether Joe Biden's theory that you can lift people up down below without fundamentally changing anything for people on top is plausible, or whether, as I believe, you can't change things for people down below in America without displacing the people standing on their necks. We are having this debate in a way that I think feels fulsome, feels exciting, feels like a real contest. And it's a bigger, broader, messier, more consequential contest of ideas than I think we usually have in a presidential primary.
That was Anand Giridhar, author of Winners Take All. He was recorded on January 16, 2020, on the topic, How Taxes, Not Philanthropy, Will Change the World. You heard excerpts from a 40-minute conversation between Giridhar and David Skok and Taylor Owen, co-hosts of the Canadian Big Tech podcast. Big Tech examines the emerging technologies that are reshaping democracy, the economy, and society. You can find the full 40-minute podcast on the website of CIGI, the Center for International Governance Innovation in Canada, or on YouTube under Big Tech CIGI. This program was edited and produced by me, Mariah Gillardin. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Mariah Gillardin. Thank you for listening.